found the track that is right for you. Your time is your most valuable asset, so spend it wisely. Let the obvious impracticalities of any deal you consider speak to you loudly. This is true no matter how apparently lucrative any deal may seem. Just because the latest and seemingly hottest franchise deal is available in your city doesn't mean that it's right for you. If flipping hamburgers in Detroit, selling cemetery plots in Guam, or polishing cars, creating signs and banners, or teaching math to preteens doesn't really fit you or create a passion within you to succeed, don't do it. Just fold up your cards and wait for a new hand to be dealt. Don't let your current circumstances, no matter how unsatisfying, chase you into a situation where you will work harder, go into debt, and actually lose money doing something you hate. The real world of me. Engage in serious introspection. Ask yourself, will doing the deal prevent me from achieving my personal life goals? Deals are like streetcars, since there's always another one coming down the track. If the deal doesn't fit, don't submit. Spend some quality time on the real world of me before you invest your time chasing a deal that just doesn't suit you or takes you to places that will ultimately make you unhappy, even if you are successful. Will the dogs like it? You've taken the time to be introspective. It's now time to look hard at the deal that's in front of you. You know, the one that looks, smells, and feels right for you. A very astute Hawaii-based Chinese businessman, whom I had the pleasure to work with in my early legal career, used to have a favorite saying to characterize any deal. He applied this saying to the many, many deals he considered. He would pause after reviewing the deal situation and ask, "But will the dogs like it?" He meant that if a deal looks good, is workable, is affordable, and is in a good location, then the customers, tenants, purchasers, etc., still have to show up to make it happen. He insisted at the outset that just because something may look right to you, it may not be quite so right to the man or woman on the street. You and your wife, partner, friend, banker, college business professor, etc., might think you have the newest take on sliced bread. However, you must take off the rose-tinted glasses and look at the deal high and low. In other words, strive for total objectivity in your deal analysis. Tip: just because something may look right to you, it may not be quite so right to the man or woman on the street. A couple of deals from my past point out the usefulness of being truly objective. In 1977, my partner, Robert Pulley, and I opened the first Burger King restaurant in the state of Hawaii, right across the street from a busy and well-located McDonald's restaurant. At that time in Hawaii, McDonald's was pretty much the whole ballgame in terms of branded quick-serve hamburgers. After sampling Burger King's food and visiting existing Burger King restaurants on the mainland, we both agreed that the concept would work well in the islands. And even before we opened in Honolulu, we had customers banging on our restaurant doors to get in while we were still obviously under construction. We realized that we had a real winner on our hands. The dogs really liked our hamburgers. We set first day, first week, and first month sales records for gross sales for the entire Burger King chain. In fact, our drive-through service lane routinely filled up and cars backed up on the very busy Barataria Street for more than a mile. We had to hire off-duty policemen to control and direct traffic for 7 months before we got things under control. Our customers fell in love with Burger King. We had a very good product that was absolutely unique to Hawaii at that time. There was a pent-up demand for fast food hamburgers other than McDonald's hamburgers. To my partner's credit, we obtained a bulletproof location right across from a key competitor that we knew was very successful. and we delivered good food fast. We had analyzed the deal objectively based on good information. In fact, as it turned out, we underestimated how much the dogs would like it. On the other hand, I had the opposite experience with the introduction of the El Pollo Loco restaurant chain into Hawaii some years later. I, along with my key employees, had eaten at El Pollo Loco in Southern California. The El Pollo Loco concept essentially involves charbroiling fresh and big fryer chickens to golden brown and serving the charbroiled chicken with tortillas, beans, and rice. The dogs really liked this product in Southern California, where there is a strong Hispanic tradition. People there of all types are quite familiar with tacos, tamales, and tortillas and fajitas. They viewed El Pollo Loco as a good Mexican food concept and made it very popular. In addition to knowing the food was good and popular, in Southern California at least, we had the money and expertise to develop the chain in premier locations in Hawaii. So we obtained the area franchise, and with the success of Burger King in Hawaii encouraging us, we felt sure we could create another major quick-serve restaurant success. We opened two El Pollo Loco locations at about the same time. Imagine our disappointment when we found that the dogs didn't like the product in Hawaii. Imagine our financial losses. The El Pollo Loco concept depended on some customer familiarity with Mexican food preparation and service. What seemed routine in terms of Mexican food service to Southern Californians mystified many, if not most, of our good Hawaiian customers. The concept involved the simple act of pulling the chicken meat off the half-chicken serving and wrapping it in a warm tortilla with beans, rice, and salsa, thereby creating a world-class chicken fajita. In Hawaii, the customers did not combine the ingredients, despite clever and instructive graphics on every table and menu. They typically ate the chicken serving, which was delicious, picked at the rice and beans, and threw the beautiful warm flour tortillas away. We were stunned. There was already huli huli, flame-broiled chicken, all over the island of Oahu, which was a popular and long-standing fundraising vehicle. Typically, community groups involved in fundraising would set up huli huli wagons in parking lots on weekends at several locations on the island. They would build charcoal fires in the huli huli wagons and proceed to prepare and sell tasty flame-broiled chickens, whole and halves, to the public at relatively inexpensive prices. So in addition to our customers' failure to grasp the El Pollo Loco concept, we had a serious competitor that we never considered until it was too late. Without the customer's grasp of the chicken fajita preparation, the El Pollo Loco chicken was simply good chicken. It wasn't really very unique, and it was pretty expensive compared to huli huli chicken. We actually didn't fail completely, but our losses forced us to sell out to Kentucky Fried Chicken. KFC wanted to get rid of El Pollo Loco on the islands, and our modest success was hurting their business. So we took the easy way out with a lesson well learned. Will the dogs like it? Is the product something that you would personally buy at the likely asking price? Is the product unique or better than the comparable products sold by competitors? Is the product too complicated or too much trouble for your customers? Take off your rose-tinted deal glasses and look at the relevant market objectively. Garbage in, garbage out. Projected financial results, as you can imagine, are the primary concern in analyzing any deal. And when it comes to the numbers, it's garbage in, garbage out. Essentially, if your sales projections or your cost projections are bad going in, the resulting projected bottom line, profit and cash flow numbers, are not only unreliable, but outright dangerous to your financial well-being. Up until now, everything we have discussed has been preparatory to real deal focus. Now it's time to get to the heart of our task. As you've seen, the numbers aren't the only consideration, but they certainly are most critical to the stop-or-go deal decision. With my focus on the development of franchise deals, I often had access to very reliable historical sales data from other franchise operations in comparable demographic areas. Typical numbers relating to fast food operations, convenience stores, gas stations, and other similar operations are often made available to the prospective franchisees in the mandatory disclosure document that each prospective franchisee must receive under the Uniform Franchise Act, enacted in most states. These pro forma, projected, numbers are useful in analyzing the deal, and other deals involving the same or similar product delivery in most franchise opportunities. Of course, using pro forma numbers to analyze a potential deal amounts to, at best, intelligent guesswork. In every case, one has to massage these pro forma numbers to fit the situation at hand. The pricing construct has to be adjusted up or down to fit the intended location. Additionally, an equally important concern is to evaluate the relevant market, assuming the dogs like the product, to arrive at reasonable projected transaction counts and customer counts. Counting heads is the first step in evaluating a fast food location. I have spent many hours personally counting every vehicle passing by my target location. In tourist locations, I often count the people who walk by every hour in high and low traffic periods. Getting a good handle on real numbers of potential customers who have direct exposure to your location is really chapter one in the sales number guessing book. So don't skip actually doing a thorough, realistic head count or traffic count. Of course, what your closest and most relevant competitor is actually achieving in gross sales is also absolutely key to your analysis of projected gross sales. And if you don't have a close competitor, you are either really lucky or, more often than not, in the wrong location altogether. I don't care how you get these competitor numbers, but you must get them. This sales data can often be discovered through a review of public tax filings, that is, gross excise tax data, or by simply interviewing your competitor's former employees or managers. You might want to hire them anyway, so you certainly can interview them. In summary, you must get solid and realistic projected gross sales numbers to avoid creating garbage-in, garbage-out projections. Projected sales are only half the story. Projected expenses are equally important when it comes to developing usable bottom-line projections. Projected expenses can almost always be estimated reasonably with hard work. We are fortunate in the United States to have the remarkably efficient distribution of goods and services at comparable and fair pricing, assuming you pay your bills on time. With the exception of utility costs and gas, which historically can make dramatic moves to the upside, your costs for food, paper, products, produce, and people tend to be relatively stable. In quick-serve restaurants, gas stations, and convenience stores, you can move your pricing daily if necessary, so you can preserve your profit margins as costs move up. Of course, you are always limited by the competitive atmosphere, but given a product or products the dogs like, reasonable pricing, and a good location, you can come up with projected financial results that are sensible enough to make a deal decision. If you have hit your mark in projecting future gross sales and have a good understanding of your expenses, you should be able to derive some fairly good and usable guesses at cash flow and profitability numbers. When I have really done my homework, I have been able to avoid the garbage-in, garbage-out syndrome that turns business projections into birdcage lining. When I didn't do the work of counting vehicles and heads, or failed to research the success or failure of my closest competitors, my deal analysis was faulty. If I failed to be diligent in projecting reliable expense numbers, I had garbage or unrealistic expense numbers to factor into my profitability formula. Sometimes I got lucky and things turned out better than I had hoped for. However, you can't rely on luck, and the mistakes that are burned into my brain resulted from overly aggressive sales projections and garbage out at the projected bottom line. Years ago, I, along with my partner Robert Pulley, built a Burger King restaurant in the heart of Waikiki in Honolulu, Hawaii. Although the site was on the ground floor in the front of the popular King's Village Shopping Center, the actual walk-by traffic seemed a little thin for this very expensive location. However, one half block away on Waikiki Beach were absolute throngs of tourists, mostly milling about at the popular corner of Liliuokalani and Kalakaua Avenues. My personal tourist headcount revealed several thousand potential customers passing through this adjacent and very popular intersection every hour. The downside of this location was that the view from this key corner to my target restaurant site was largely blocked by a ticket and information booth. A bad deal. So if I was going to choose this site, I'd have to adjust my sales projections way down. After all, they were based on actual walk-by traffic at the time. The obstruction by the ticket booth meant there was nothing to draw customers our way from that busy corner. My partner and I fortunately engaged in some what-if analysis before passing on this potentially great site. Our conclusion was that if we could create unobstructed sightline visibility from this major tourist corner to our site, the deal would work. So I made a last-minute potential deal-breaker demand to the landlord that the offending ticket booth be removed to clear up the sightline. Fortunately, the landlord agreed. They wanted us in the center. So we ended up with probably the most successful quick-serve restaurant I have ever built. The dogs liked us. Now they could see us. And there were plenty of dogs. Our first year sales were more than $2.7 million out of less than 2,700 square feet. These are Hall of Fame numbers for fast food. On the other hand, I once developed a cemetery on a parcel of land that my then partner, Bernard Bays, also a contributor in this book, and I had acquired to develop high-end residential condominiums. How did a parcel of land go from high-end condos to burial plots? Simple answer. Hurricane Iniki and ancient but unmarked graves on the property. As you can well imagine, everyone I knew razzed me with the old joke, "Hey, John, I hear people are dying to get into your new project." Yeah, wrong kind of dying. All joking aside, the gross sales potential on paper from any new cemetery is just phenomenal. Anytime you can convert, as an example, 6 acres into 6,000 saleable grave plots in a major metro area, your potential ultimate sellout can be as high as $15 to $20 million. Since our land was already paid for, I had only to face cemetery approval and development costs, which I had a pretty good handle on. So I constructed some very elaborate and detailed sales and cash flow projections that convinced Bays, myself, and several of our associates that we had a winner indeed, even if it wasn't via condo development. The cash flow to cost ratio was very favorable on what seemed to be ultimately reasonable sales projections. Our deal analysis looked really good. But it was very wrong. Unfortunately, I grossly overestimated how quickly people would buy burial plots in the cemetery. We had originally built the cemetery with the thought of selling it to a major company involved in the funeral home/cemetery business. In fact, we had a basic agreement that this company would run the cemetery and ultimately buy the operation and property at a price yielding a substantial profit to our group. So even though we really had no experience actually operating a cemetery, we proceeded to develop it anyway. We wrongly assumed that our deal to sell to the pros would go through before we actually had to operate the cemetery business. The projected cash flow made us confident of closing such a sale. Unfortunately, our prospective buyers went into bankruptcy a short time after completion of the cemetery. There I was, a fast food impresario, taking over cemetery operations. I was stuck with the job as head cemeterian, which I knew little about and greatly disliked. I soldiered ahead because our projected numbers still looked terrific. We still had millions of dollars in unsold inventory already paid for and waiting to be sold. I just didn't figure that it might take my lifetime to sell this inventory. Talk about garbage in, garbage out. I would likely be buried in this cemetery, and there still would be more than half the plots left to sell. Many years later, after investing countless and thankless hours learning about and actually running the cemetery, I finally ended up selling it at a loss. My partners and I are now much older and wiser. My projections of cemetery plot sales were based on selling significant numbers of plots from the get-go. We did finally begin to see significant sales of plots every month. However, this sales tempo took years to achieve. What I did not factor into my projected plot sales was the essential attribute of heritage, which every new cemetery must gain slowly, if at all, before significant plot sales can be achieved. This is particularly true in smaller cities with more limited population bases. The simple truth is that it is hard to get families to bury their deceased loved ones in new places. If auntie and uncle are buried in the public cemetery, the rest of the family will also likely want to be interred there, no matter how seedy the old town cemetery has become. People will come to a new cemetery, but it takes time. They are dying to get in, but just not fast enough at a new cemetery. So my decision to proceed to build a cemetery was driven by sales projections that were honestly derived, but simply too aggressive for this kind of business. This was particularly true since we lost our major cemetery consolidator slash operator at the very outset. My deal analysis was faulty because of overly aggressive garbage sales projections. Garbage in, garbage out. Access and use sales numbers from the best sources available, franchisor standard disclosures and competitor numbers, for example. Count the heads and or traffic personally. Do your homework when you work up expense projections. Ask the what-if question before passing on a deal. If you build it to sell, you better have a bulletproof buyer. Build it and they will come. Or not. Now that I have discussed some practical concerns that will prepare you for getting into a deal and shared some stories and my opinion about the relevance of numbers to every deal, it's time to focus on the question of location. Although I have related most of my discussion to quick-serve restaurants, convenience stores, and related businesses, the location question is central to analyzing any real estate deal. It is often said that the three most important aspects of any real estate deal are location, location, and location. This is true, true, and true in any fast food type deal, but it is also the compelling issue in most real estate deals. Certainly, it is the central issue in the real estate deals I am referring to in this chapter. Choosing the right locations for fast food, quick serve, gas, and convenience store businesses becomes an art after you have done it time and again and enjoyed success and experienced failures. I discussed previously in the numbers analysis section the importance of counting heads and checking competitor sales. I also stressed that the visibility of any site is a key part of this location issue. And finally, I emphasized being in an area where the demographics support your product, where it is both needed and wanted by the people. Remember, will the dogs like it? For as simple as those concepts seem, be assured that you cannot properly analyze any real estate deal involving commercial sales to the public without paying close attention to these basic principles of site selection. Take it from someone who has learned these lessons the hard way. In most cases, the location you want and are sure of is easy to figure out, but is unavailable because of zoning, expense, public ownership, size, too big to afford or too small to be workable, and or access. The locations that are available often are available because no one wants them or can afford them. This is especially true in major metro areas. If the site is available, you'd better go slow because usually there's something wrong with it. Never assume your competitors are dumb or lazy. Proceed with caution or you will build the perfect store and nobody will come. I can't tell you how many times I have fortunately passed on real estate deals that were just about right, meaning just about in a great location, but were slightly off for one reason or another. Maybe the site was just interior from the key dominant corner, or was in a perfect corner location, but on the second floor, or down a half flight of stairs. Or the site was blocked by a huge banyan tree, ticket booth, adjacent building, or some other obstruction so you couldn't see it from the coming home side of the road. I will assure you that you can't build or manage your way out of a poor location, no matter how hard you try or how much you spend. I refer here to my area of expertise involving quick-serve restaurants and convenience and gas facilities. However, I believe this location issue is at the heart of every deal that involves sales to the general public. Aside from location visibility, access for your customers is another important consideration. I have thankfully passed on a number of sites that seemed perfectly located, but suffered from limited access because of traffic, traffic controls, or limited parking. If it's not convenient, the dogs will pass on by to someplace that's easier to deal with. So if you build on a location that your customers can't get to, they won't come. My partner, Robert Pulley, and I had some fantastic successes by securing locations that were seemingly unavailable or unattainable for our quick-serve hamburger restaurants. I mentioned above the Waikiki location with the problematic ticket booth. Once we got rid of this visual impairment, we had an absolute grade A location. We had many other successes that I like to think were enabled by creative thinking and action. When I was looking for deals that would compete favorably with my number one competitor, McDonald's, I had to be creative, since this competitor had seemingly tied up all the available, really good locations. I always laughed when a real estate broker would tell me that I was ahead of McDonald's on any particular site, or that I was being offered the site first. I assumed, usually with complete accuracy, that any site McDonald's wanted in my city would end up in their hands no matter who else was interested. They were definitely the big kahuna in my development area, and they usually got the first right of refusal on any newly available sites. I guess it's good to be the real boss. So I, along with my partner, had to think creatively if we were going to grow and succeed. Our deal analysis on sites had to be not only accurate, but innovative. This creative mindset led us to open the first nationally branded fast food outlet ever in a U.S. military installation at the Navy Exchange at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. We lost this location some years later when we sold out to a Japanese company, but that is another story. We opened, with great success, the first fast food restaurant with a partner in the Honolulu International Airport. And we opened the first national fast food franchise operation in a Hawaii public park at Ala Moana Park in downtown Honolulu. We actually retrofitted part of a YMCA building to create a Burger King restaurant next to the University of Hawaii, which was another first. We definitely had to be creative in our site selection to survive and grow our company. We actually built 5 or more of the most successful restaurants in terms of sales volume in the history of quick-serve restaurants. In every case, the successful location was equal or superior to our competitors' locations or was uniquely situated to avoid any competition. In every case, the location was the key to our success. Our deal analysis was spot on in these unique locations. However, I would be less than honest if I didn't tell you about a couple of bad experiences I've had because of poor site selection. By that, I mean I built it and they didn't come. The first example involved building a very fancy and expensive Burger King restaurant on the ground floor of a high-end residential condominium that my partner had developed in Waikiki. Honestly, my site deal analysis was skewed by the ready availability of this commercial site, which my partner had in his back pocket as the condominium developer. What I didn't see were some major problems with this captive site, although it was located on a busy Waikiki corner. First, the dogs didn't like it. The homeowners were less than enamored by a fast food hamburger restaurant at the entrance to their new exclusive and expensive condominium complex. To add further insult, a fellow high-end restaurant tenant sued to stop our restaurant's construction as a violation of his exclusivity clause. But the real oversight in our deal analysis was that our location was on the busy corner, but one half floor below street grade. The walk-by traffic didn't seem to find our location because it was below their sight line. A final straw was that even though there were hundreds of cars passing by every hour, there was no parking. Here's a lesson I learned that is for everyone. If you are in the convenience food store business, you had better be convenient and readily accessible. I have never had much success in this quick-serve convenience area when I locate below or above street level. So in analyzing site locations, don't count on too much tenacity or insight on the part of your customers. They just don't care that much. My experience in developing, owning, and operating a nightclub was equally painful. In this instance, a close personal friend, Robert Mardian Jr., had given me some solid advice against building this club on the big island of Hawaii. He was in the club business there as well and knew the ropes. Unfortunately, I ignored that good advice and proceeded with the nightclub development. My reason for going forward was simply that I had space in a warehouse complex that I owned, which had already been substantially built out as a nightclub at great expense. I recaptured the space after my tenant defaulted. That should have been my first clue, and I decided the best idea was to finish out the club and operate it. So I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars building a state-of-the-art nightclub that opened with considerable fanfare. Unfortunately, I soon found out that even if the dogs liked the club, they wouldn't come if they couldn't find it. Tip: another important and costly lesson I learned is that you can't turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. I made 2 major mistakes here concerning location. I had failed to heed the clear and sound advice from a knowledgeable consultant who advised me that the club would fail because of location. Also, I should have known that no matter how much money you spend, you cannot build yourself out of a bad location. This just wasn't appropriate space for a nightclub because it was in the back of an industrial warehouse that was off the beaten track. People who actually wanted to come couldn't find it. I used to joke that people just needed to drive until they heard gunfire. This was a rough area late at night. I ended up disliking the nightclub business as much as the cemetery business. By now, I think you get it. Deals where the location is bad, bad, and bad won't work no matter what you do. We finally tore out the nightclub improvements and returned it to warehouse use. The entire complex has been full since. Another important and costly lesson I learned is that you can't turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. Build it and they will come. Or not. Location, location, location is true, true, and true. Count heads, review access and visibility, and check out the competition. If the site is readily available, there is probably something wrong with it. Think outside the box to get unique locations. If you are in the convenience business, you'd better be convenient. Seek out and listen to the experts. Don't try to turn a sow's ear into a silk purse. Trouble with travel. With any deal you are considering, you simply have to ask yourself, can I manage the deal effectively? If the deal is located more than one day's travel from your home, you'd better ask and answer some serious questions about your personal span of control. You can't manage the type of deals I've been discussing by staring at a computer. You need to be at the site at least weekly if you are the majority partner. Or you'd better have a good, capable, and trustworthy operator or partner. And that leads to an important point. One of the most important considerations in analyzing whether to proceed with any real estate deal or development is the availability of good management. And usually the key to good management is your personal involvement in the development and operation. Having good partners can solve many of the concerns about good management. However, if your own money is at risk in any deal, it will require your personal attention. The question, then, is whether, realistically, you will actually be able to devote sufficient time to a deal to make it successful. I have found if a deal or operation is located too far from my home base or is difficult to get to, I won't pay enough personal oversight and attention to the situation to ensure good management. I've also found that it is very rare to see any deal run on its own without major problems. If I have to get on an airplane or drive several hours to a location, you are not going to see me very often. It really amounts to the trouble with travel. I once stretched the limit concerning my effective span of control by agreeing to be a founding member of a company formed to develop Subway sandwich restaurants in the old Soviet Union. Before we got the first restaurant built, the Soviet Union imploded, so we had to be satisfied with the nation of Russia, with only 300 million people or so. My major point here is that you don't need to travel to the other side of the world to find trouble. You can usually find plenty of trouble right at home. How I ever got involved in Soviet subway restaurants is a story of seduction. I was intoxicated by the sheer potential magnitude of a deal that involved an entire nation. Despite the fact that it happened to be Russia, a mere 12,500 miles from my home. The prevalent kleptocracy that seemed to be the dominant ideology in the early 90s in Russia should have raised a cautionary note in my Russia deal analysis. The fact that I would have very little to do with day-to-day management of the restaurants should also have raised my personal red flag. Despite these serious roadblocks to good deal formation, I, along with some other U.S. partners, built the first Subway sandwich restaurant in Russia on Nevsky Prospect in St. Petersburg. It took some real creativity and out-of-the-box thinking to build a workable and visible restaurant in a 200-year-old building. The restaurant was a rousing success, primarily because I sent one of my very best partners from Hawaii, Steve Brown, along with his wife, Roberta, to build and run the Russian subway operations. Of course, Steve was also enamored with the prospect of owning part of the 100 or more subway restaurants we intended to build throughout Russia. So I am not entirely to blame for disrupting his life. Shockingly, we were taking in wheelbarrow loads of rubles, literally, and lots of hard currency, dollars, marks, etc., from the very start of operations in St. Petersburg. Under Steve's management, with some help from me and the other three principals, we had one of the most successful Subway sandwich restaurants in the world for about 3 months. After weeks of hard work and success, Steve and Roberta finally took a short trip out of Russia to decompress, leaving one of our partners in charge as the managing director, which was required by Russian corporate law. Call it confusion about travel plans and return dates, but we had literally one day without a so-called managing director in charge of operations in St. Petersburg. Our Russian partner, whom we took on at the outset of our plans because of his apparent control over some key real estate and his political connections, chose that day to make his move. He had been sitting on the sidelines as we operated for 90 days without any active part in management. He expressed great frustration that we were banking all our net receipts to pay startup bills before making any partner distributions. What we didn't realize at the time was that our partner had some very bad characters who had control over him and were part of a major Russian mob. Under mob instructions, we think, he was waiting for his chance to gain control over the restaurant as managing director. He seized that one day's opportunity. When Steve Brown returned from Russia a day later, he found our Russian partner's security people, formerly our security people, ex-KGB apparently, in charge. They literally ran Steve out of the restaurant at gunpoint. So we lost control of the restaurant and the backing we had lined up to build many more restaurants. And our Russian partner soon ran the existing restaurant into the ground. Talk about a mess. Despite the fact that our company finally got the restaurant back years later, we all lost most of our investment in this deal. Now, we may ultimately get back some of our money as my old U.S. partners continue to build Subway sandwich restaurants through franchise agreements in Russia under the auspices of our former company. However, I have often reflected on my poor decision in getting involved in a deal so far from home and on hazardous turf we knew little about. I can't help but repeat that you don't need to travel halfway around the world to invest your way into trouble. There are plenty of landmines to step on right here at home. The trouble with travel. The trouble with travel is that it reduces your span of control. Will you actually go there after you have built it? Deals don't run on their own. Foreign countries are especially dangerous turf. You don't have to leave home to find trouble. Deals are like parachutes. So far, we've covered many of the considerations involved in analyzing and negotiating good deals. Now let's discuss the importance of getting out of a bad or marginal deal. Think of deals as if they were parachutes. If you're free-falling or sinking fast, you need to be able to pull the ripcord to save yourself and get out of a deal that's simply not working. That means, first and foremost, determine whether you can negotiate an out clause in your initial deal analysis. If you don't succeed in obtaining this concession from the landlord or seller, you may want to pass on the deal. When I first started building restaurants, my partner and I routinely signed personal guarantees on leases for long-term leasehold properties. We were reaching to obtain the best real estate available and believed, in many cases correctly, that we had no chance to obtain these superior sites without kissing the paper, which is another way of saying signing personal guarantees. We ultimately stopped doing this, since a personal guarantee on a long-term lease is like a life sentence. If the lease term is long enough, you have to worry about whether the lease rent is being paid for the rest of your life. This is especially true if you have assigned this lease to someone else. Although we ultimately got our names off most of these guarantees when we sold the restaurants and assigned these long-term leases, in some instances we could not get releases because the landlords were just too tough. And our marker, guarantee, was called in a couple of times by landlords who we had no dealings with for years. So if a personal guarantee is demanded, you must carefully consider whether you want to accept this liability for the term of the lease or loan. This extra liability greatly burdens the benefit of any potential deal and should be factored into your deal decision-making. After a couple of bad experiences, I not only stopped giving my personal guarantee on lease deals, but I began to insist on ripcord clauses to get out of leases that proved to be for marginal locations. In most instances, landlords met this demand for an out of a long-term real estate lease with stiff resistance or refusal. My resolve to leave a partially open door to get out of a bad deal was equally strong. My negotiating stance was to point out that I would be fronting significant improvement costs at the outset, which I would not walk away from without a really compelling reason. Sometimes I was able to negotiate only a qualified release from my personal guarantee, which was better than nothing. For example, my personal guarantee would go away after the rent had been paid for a short term of 3 to 5 years, or on payment of a lump sum. But I was always prepared to walk away from deals that were just too tough in terms of personal guarantees or long-term lock-ins. Deals are like parachutes. A long-term personal guarantee can amount to a life sentence. Negotiate a ripcord clause in long-term leases if possible. Be prepared to walk if terms are too tough. Make my day, make my life. At some point in every viable real estate deal, you have the opportunity, or at least the consideration, of whether or not to sell. In my experience, the decision to sell or not to sell is usually an easy or obvious one. If the price is right, everything is for sale. The analysis issue is which course of action, sale or retention, will optimize the return from your deal. I have personally made some great selling decisions and also some pretty bad decisions that irk me to this day. Generally speaking, there are certain rules of thumb that are commonly used in the sale of operating businesses. Of course, these rules can be warped in 100 different ways to accommodate the unique features of every different deal. Fast food restaurants often sell based on a ratio of annual, trailing 12-month, cash flow. 6 times annual cash flow is generally considered at the high end, while 4.5 times cash flow is considered at the low end of selling prices for such operating businesses. And my reference to cash flow really more correctly refers to earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, or EBITDA, or EBITDA. There are other variations of this cash flow acronym, but this is the one I use. Of course, operating businesses are sold for all kinds of reasons and all kinds of prices. I remember an old legend concerning the sale of a gas station / convenience store. Essentially, the owner of this business was a sharp operator who was trying to push the sales price beyond normal cash flow rules of thumb. So every time a potential buyer was due to inspect the business, the owner would dump trash around the buildings, leave the restrooms in a mess, and generally present an untidy, dirty appearance about the business. Then, when the buyer showed up, the owner would take him aside and point out the seemingly obvious fact that if someone would just run the business properly, sales and profits would soar. It is also common for the owner or seller and spouse to add back to the cash flow their salaries, car allowance, expense account, etc., to pump up the cash flow. This is true even if the owner or seller and spouse are the very heart of the business management and operation. Owners play all kinds of games with the sale of operating businesses. More sophisticated buyers and sellers will rely on industry norms concerning cash flow and a real objective analysis of the numbers to arrive at a price. Robert Pulley and I sold our Burger King restaurants in Hawaii at a price that approached 1x the gross sales, which probably doesn't happen very often. However, we had a business in the seemingly terrific state of Hawaii. We had good management and good locations, and we had enthusiastic foreign buyers. The analysis of whether to sell or not, in our case, was an easy yes. I have sold restaurants at other times on the 6x cash flow multiple, but I personally have not seen another deal with a price approaching parity with gross sales. Analyzing the deal in raw land sales, presuming one has staying power to hold on to the land, relates basically to the greed factor. How much gain is enough? There are no real rules of thumb concerning the sale of raw land or development land. You need to make the hard decision of whether holding the land or the further development of the land will justify holding costs. Of course, these decisions to sell raw land are often driven by the owner's inability to continue to pay carrying costs. In cases where you are going to lose the property otherwise, selling becomes an easy decision. My most memorable mistakes in terms of selling prematurely involve selling houses in Hawaii that practically doubled in value a year or two after my sale. We all have had or know of examples of seller's remorse and personal house sales. This was particularly true in many areas of the United States that were experiencing explosive increases in house prices. I, along with lots of other sellers, failed to judge the rapid upward move of the market. Of course, failure to sell during market peak can be an equally grievous error. We also have become familiar with holding strategies that lead to dramatic losses in rapidly declining residential and commercial real estate markets. There are factors other than price that may impact the decision to sell or to buy. You might decide to sell if you no longer are able to manage a business or take care of a house. You may know of planned major infrastructure changes that will impact the relevant market negatively or positively. You might want to sell to key employees to avoid losing them. In every case, the analysis of the deal, or the sale, requires every bit as much consideration as a deal to build or acquire. Make my day, make my life. Utilize common rules of thumb to reach a realistic valuation decision. Cash flow, rather than assets, determines sales prices, usually. Unless you have a crystal ball, you can get burned on market directions, up or down. If you can't afford the deal, you need to sell it. Don't miss a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to sell. That is the make my day, make my life decision. Ways to learn more. Look for future writings by John Finney on the adventures on real estate. Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. ABCs of Real Estate Investing by Ken McElroy.
John Finney is the current president of Industrial Income Properties Incorporated, a company he formed to find, develop, own, and operate real estate ranging from residential and office condominiums, cattle ranches, fast food restaurants with adjunct convenience store and gas facilities, single-family residences, farm properties, nightclubs, and other real estate ventures in Hawaii, Guam, and the western United States. Prior to that, he and his partner, Robert W. Pulley, secured the Burger King franchise rights in Hawaii and in 10 years opened 35 stores and sold them in one of the biggest deals in Burger King history. And each has had many other real estate ventures in the United States. John is an attorney and a graduate of Stanford Law School and a former U.S. Marine.
10. Scott D. McPherson. Real Estate Due Diligence. I met Scott in 1999 at the Phoenix Open Golf event. I knew of his reputation as one of the biggest mortgage bankers in Arizona, but I did not know that he knew me. Smiling as he walked up, he said, "I'm glad you're saying what you say about stocks and mutual funds. They're terrible investments." At the time, I was under blistering attacks from financial planners and financial magazines that were supported by mutual fund companies' advertising dollars. You may recall that in 1999, the stock market was red hot, and people believed they were making billions in the new economy of the dot-com world. So to have a person of Scott's reputation back up my philosophy that stocks and mutual funds were risky investments was a welcome relief and validation. His pat on my back made watching the Phoenix Open even more enjoyable. Today, Scott is one of the three mortgage bankers I call when I need the straight story about real estate financing. It was Scott who, years ago, warned me of the real estate bubble being formed by the subprime mortgage fiasco. It was because of Scott that my wife Kim and I became more conservative in our real estate investments, while others became real estate gamblers. I'm an advocate for financial education because when you get smarter, you minimize risk. That's what this chapter is about. Scott has made me smarter, and the knowledge he has shared with me minimizes my risk with every new investment I make. His wisdom in this chapter will do the same for you. Robert Kiyosaki.
When talking about the subject of real estate due diligence, you are really talking about nothing more than a team effort of discovery and verification. That's what due diligence is. And every real estate transaction you do, whether it is a single-family home purchase or a very complex commercial real estate development, will require the buyer to take certain fundamental steps of underwriting. Only through that process can a buyer fully assess all aspects of the property he or she is purchasing. And if you are the buyer, you'll want to make sure you are diligent about due diligence. Tip: Benjamin Franklin once said, "Diligence is the mother of good luck." When you as a real estate investor have identified a property that you want to purchase, you have come to the conclusion to buy it based on a series of somewhat superficial facts. You have usually seen the property and generally have reviewed some of the financial information that the seller or broker has provided you. And based on this information and your belief that the property fits your business plan, you make an offer to purchase. Once the seller has accepted your offer, your work, or should I say your team's work, has just begun. I am a real believer in putting together a very strong team when you approach a real estate acquisition. Many of the authors in this book have stated the exact same thing in their chapters. The fact is, most highly successful people or companies are built using a team approach to getting things done. No one can be an expert on every aspect of real estate. And frankly, if you are investing on behalf of other people and are using their money, you should always seek competent third-party input. In this chapter, I'm going to walk you through a due diligence process and give you an overview of why the various members of your team are important. I'm also going to include my 8 tips and some real-life examples of why securing qualified and unbiased advice on your proposed acquisition is so critical. To me, assembling a team to assist you with your due diligence is just like putting a puzzle together. Each of the team members have separate and specialized disciplines, but when they are brought together by you as the leader, the pieces come together. And all of a sudden, the full picture comes to life. You can see what you are really buying. I have separated the due diligence